As we are making our way through the text of 1 Samuel, we've looked at chapter 15, chapter 16, and chapter 17. Somebody asked me, are you going to read 1 Samuel 17? My answer is yes, I'm going to read 1 Samuel 17. The text dominates us, and I'm going to read it from the New Living Translation, so you'll have to follow on carefully, but I do this so that you might be able to maybe catch some things that you maybe haven't seen before. I was yesterday watering. We have 6 hydrangea plants out front, and so I was watering them yesterday, and as I was watering, across the street from us is the woods, and I was just standing there watching. I saw things I hadn't seen before. The beauty of Mrs. Cardinal and Mr. Cardinal as they were playing something in there. The beauty of the leaves and the trees, you know, sometimes just to stop and to look, something that's so familiar to me comes alive to me when I begin to really focus. When I look at 1 Samuel 17, you hold in your hand, when you look at 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, you combine these books together. When you look at 1 Samuel 17, you are holding or looking or reading the longest battle narrative of the Samuels, 912 Hebrew words. You also have more conversations in this story than in any other story of the Samuels. There are 22. Think of that. This chapter gives to us the longest quotation by a pagan. His name is, all right, Goliath, verses 8 and 9, 33 words. This chapter gives to us the very first recorded words of David in the biblical text. Until this point, David's voice has been silent. It was silent in chapter 16, according to the biblical text. Now, for the first time, he speaks, and there are actually 3 messages, powerful messages of David. I want you to note those as we walk through this text. This chapter gives to us the most detailed description of military attire anywhere in the Old Testament as it defines the mammoth man called Goliath and what he's wearing. It also gives us one of the most gory details as David chops his head off. But the most important thing about 1 Samuel 17 is that it was quoted by Mark Twain. Tom Sawyer's knowledge of all of the scriptures came down to David and Goliath. Even the pagan world has heard of this story. Sunday school kids know of this story. One of the most well-known stories, David and Goliath. I won't make you stand for the 912 Hebrew words, okay? But I want you to follow on your text as I make it through the New Living and grasp, if you will, the text. Because this is the word of the Spirit to Colonial Baptist Church today. The Philistines now mustered their army for battle and camped between Succo and Judah and Azekah and Ephes Damim. Saul countered by gathering his troops near the valley of Elah. So the Philistines and Israelites faced each other on opposite hills between the valley and the valley between them. Then Goliath, a Philistine champion from Gath, came out of the Philistine ranks to face the forces of Israel. He was a giant of a man, measuring over 9 feet tall. He wore a bronze helmet and a coat of mail that weighed 125 pounds. When you weigh out the shekels, it's actually 125 pounds, 15 ounces. He also wore bronze leggings, and he slung a bronze javelin over his back. The shaft of his spear was as heavy and thick as a weaver's beam tipped with an iron spearhead that weighed 15 pounds. An armor bearer walked ahead of him carrying a huge body shield. Goliath stood and shouted across to the Israelites, "Do you need a whole army to settle this? Choose someone to fight for you, and I will represent the Philistines. We will settle this dispute in a single combat. If your man is able to kill me, then we will be your slaves. But if I kill him, you will be our slaves. I defy the armies of Israel. Send me a man who will fight with me." When Saul and the Israelites heard this, they were terrified and deeply shaken. Now David was the son of a man named Jesse, an Ephrathite from Bethlehem in the land of Judah. Jesse was an old man at the time. He had 8 sons in all. Jesse's 3 oldest sons, Eliab, Aminadab, and Shammah, had already joined Saul's army to fight the Philistines. David was the youngest of Jesse's sons. Since David's three oldest brothers were in the army, they stayed with Saul's forces all the time. But, this goes back to chapter 16, but David went back and forth between working for Saul and helping his father with sheep in Bethlehem. For 40 days, twice a day, morning and evening, the Philistine giant strutted in front of the Israelite army. One day Jesse said to David, "Take this half bushel of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread to your brothers, and give these 10 cuts of cheese to their captain. See how your brothers are getting along, and bring me back a letter from them." David's brothers were with Saul and the Israelite army at the Valley of Elah fighting against the Philistines. So David left the sheep with another shepherd and set out early the next morning with the gifts. He arrived at the outskirts of the camp just as the Israelite army was leaving for the battle with shouts and with battle cries. Soon the Israelite and the Philistine forces stood facing one another, army against army. David left his things with the keeper of supplies and hurried out to the ranks to greet his brothers. As he was talking with them, he saw Goliath, the champion from Gath, come out from the Philistine ranks, shouting his challenges to the army of Israel. As soon as the Israelite army saw him, they began to run in fright. "Have you seen the giant?" the men were asking. "He comes out each day to challenge Israel. Have you heard about the huge reward the king has offered to anyone who kills him? The king will give him one of his daughters for a wife, and his whole family will be exempt from paying taxes." I like that. That's not in Hebrew. David talked to some others standing there to verify the report. "What will a man get for killing this Philistine?" Remember, these are the first words of David in the text. "What will a man get for killing this Philistine and putting an end to his abuse of Israel?" he asked them. "Who is this pagan Philistine anyway that he is allowed to defy the armies of the living God?" And David received the same reply as before. "What you have been hearing is true. This is the reward for killing the giant." But when David's oldest brother Eliab heard David talking to the men, he was angry. "What are you doing around here anyway?" he demanded. "What about those few sheep you're supposed to be taking care of? I know your pride and your dishonesty. You just want to see the battle." "What have I done?" David replied. "I'm only asking a question." He walked over to some others and asked them the same and received the same answer. Then David's question was reported to King Saul, and the king sent for him. "Don't worry about a thing," David told Saul. "I'll finish this Philistine." "Don't be ridiculous," Saul replied. "There is no way you can go against this Philistine. You are only a boy, and he has been in the army since he was a boy." But David persisted. "I have been taking care of my father's sheep," he said. "When a lion or a bear comes to steal the lamb from the flock, I go after it with a club and take the lamb from its mouth. If the animal turns on me, I catch it by the jaw and club it to death. I have done this to both lions and bears," plural. "And I'll do it to this pagan Philistine too, for he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who saved me from the claws of the lion and bear will save me from the Philistine." Saul finally consented. "All right, go ahead. And may the Lord be with you." Then Saul gave David his own armor, a bronze helmet, a coat of mail. David put it on, strapped the sword over it, took a step or two to see what it was like, for he had never worn such things before. "I can't go in these," he protested. "I'm not used to them." He took them off again. He picked up 5 smooth stones from a stream and put them in a shepherd's bag. Then, armed only with his shepherd's staff and sling, he started across to fight Goliath. Goliath walked out toward David with his shield bearer ahead of him, sneering in contempt at this ruddy-faced boy. "Am I a dog?" he roared at David. "That you come at me with a stick." And he cursed David by the name of his gods. "Come over here and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals," Goliath yelled. David shouted in reply, "You come to me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. Today the Lord will conquer you, and I will kill you and cut off your head. And then I will give the dead bodies of your men to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know there is a God in Israel. And everyone will know that the Lord does not need weapons to rescue his people. It is his battle, not ours. The Lord will give you to us. As Goliath moved closer to attack, David quickly ran out to meet him. Reaching into his shepherd's bag, taking out a stone, he hurled it from his sling and hit the Philistine in the forehead. The stone sank in. In other words, it embedded itself in the forehead of Goliath. And Goliath stumbled and fell face downward to the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine giant with only a stone and sling. And since he had no sword, he ran over and pulled Goliath's sword from its sheath. David used it to kill the giant and cut off his head. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they turned and ran. Then the Israelites gave a great shout of triumph and rushed after the Philistines, chasing them as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron. The bodies of the dead and wounded Philistines were strewn all along the road from the Shamarim as far as Gath and Ekron. Then the Israelite army returned and plundered the deserted Philistine camp. David took Goliath's head to Jerusalem, but he stored the Philistines' armor in his own tent. As Saul watched David go out to fight Goliath, he asked Abner, the general of his army, "Abner, whose son is he?" "I really don't know," Abner said, "but we'll find out." After David had killed Goliath, Abner brought him to Saul and the Philistine's head still in his hand. "Tell me about your father, my boy," Saul said. And David replied, "His name is Jesse, and we live in Bethlehem." When I look at this chapter, men and women, I want you to look at verse number 47, because I just have a few minutes to go through. And the way I want to do is take this verse as the key verse. Remember chapter 15, a key verse. And the key verse is telling us in chapter 15, obedience is more important than worship. It's the foundation of worship. Chapter 16, we learned last week that God does not look as man looks. Man looks on the appearance, God looks on the heart. So heart before appearance, last week. This week, verse 47, right in the middle of the verse, the battle is whose? The battle is the Lord's. That's your point. The battle is the Lord's. And as you follow the text through, since the battle is the Lord's, look how verse 47 begins. Then all this assembly shall know, David said, that there is a Lord. You see, since the battle is the Lord's, point two, since the battle is the Lord's, then his name is to be exalted. The whole earth is to know that there is an Elohim. The third point in verse 47 is powerful. That if the battle is the Lord's, or since the battle is the Lord's, then God will use whatever method he wants to fight the battle. And what does it say in verse 47? All going to know that the Lord does not save with approved military means, spear and sword. And finally, the last sentence of verse 47 is overwhelming to me. Since the battle is the Lord's, the outcome is already determined. And he will give you into our hands. Verse 47 is key to the entire chapter. The battle is the Lord's. Since the battle is the Lord's, the name of the Lord is to be glorified. Since the battle is the Lord's, he'll use whatever method he desires. And since the battle is the Lord, the outcome's already determined. Now let me just say up front that this is not a passage that is absolutely mutilated by people who speak about giants in their life. This is a mutilation of the text. People talk about, well, I've got a giant of a bad habit. People use this text, I've got this giant of a physical defect, or I have a giant of a relationship, husband, wife, parent, child, boss, whatever it might be. And this is the giant in my life, and Lord, please come slay this giant. Little kids go to Sunday school and find out that the giant is a big bully who lives down the street, and they're praying, Lord, slay the bully, you know. That's a mutilation of the text. You say, well, Pastor, why do you say that? Because that's not what I say. It's what the text is saying. If you'll note, look at verse number 10 of chapter 17. Look at the word that is used here in chapter 10, or verse 10, excuse me. And the Philistines said, and I'm back in the New King James here, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. Look at verse 25. The men are speaking. And the men of Israel said in verse 25, have you seen this man who comes up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. David speaks in verse 26. How does he end at the end of verse 26? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? Verse 45. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with sword and spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied, because you have spoken in taunts to Israel. You are speaking in taunts to God. Because you are mocking the armies of Israel, you are mocking the God of Israel. And because you are scorning the armies of Israel, you are scorning God. This story is not about some giant in your life. It is about the giant of Gath, who had a despicable understanding in his mind of the Israel, and the God of Israel was nothing to him. I mean, here is a guy that if he walked on the basketball court, his head would be 3 inches below the basketball rim. I mean, that's about 3 inches. His head, basketball rim. I mean, here is a guy who has 126 pounds of bronze covering him, who has a bronze helmet. The only place that is open is his face. He has a full body shield in front of him carried by a very strong man. And he comes into the presence of Israel and he defies God. That's why my second point is in verse number 47, and David's point is, then all of this assembly shall know that the Lord, that Yahweh, does not save with sword and spear. David wants everyone to know, the entire assembly, he wants the Israelites who are afraid, and he wants the Philistines who don't care, both of them, to see that God is alive. So when I look at the battle as the Lord's, I'm overwhelmed by the accent, the theological accent of the story. The theological accent of the story is not on the smallness of David, on the sling of David, on the stone of David. It's not on the largeness of the giant. It's on the greatness of God. And when you think that this giant faced this incredible foe who slung out a stone of the size of a tennis ball, traveling between 100 to 150 miles an hour, and it embeds itself, it literally crushes the frontal cranium and embeds itself in the forehead of the giant. What happened was this: God, with hurricane force, took that stone and walloped the giant. His death ensued with his head being cut off. You see, Zechariah at the end of the Old Testament says, it's not by might, it's not by power, but it's by my spirit, says the Lord. We live in an age where we can handle everything. We can do everything. And it's not about the Lord. It's about our intellect. It's about our desires. It's about our wants. And the battle is the Lord's. Is right now the Lord's. Not was the Lord's. I hope it's going to be the Lord's. The battle is the Lord's. Not only is the battle of the Lord, but I notice in verse number 47 that he is going to exalt his name. Look back at, if you will, verse number 26, and you see the last two words of in the New King James translation, David is speaking the first words of David. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the, what kind of God? He is the living God. Verse number 36, the same phrase, you see it again. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God. See, it's a living God. That is a significant statement, because what the people are seeing is a living giant. And because the living giant had the focus of their eyes and not the Elohim of heaven or the Yahweh of heaven, they did not see God as alive. They saw him as dead. The way they were acting, God is dead. And what is in front of them is a living giant. And David is going to say, wait a second. There is a living God. And then I don't know where in the world, men and women, where in the world does David get the theological understanding of who God is? I mean, I don't know how many people in this audience are under 25 years of age. Let me just see. I can't. Wow. It's amazing. This person is under 25 years of age, probably around 20. He's a single, so he's out of high school. He's already been through colonial homeschool graduation, so he's a single. But where does he get this incredible understanding of who God is? He is a living God. You see a living giant. I see a living God, and there's no comparison. And the king says, man, you better have my coat of armor. And Eliab says, oh, you're just being dishonest. Nobody's getting it. But one single. Nobody's getting it. The second usage of God is when he says living God. Every time he uses living God, it's Elohim. The majestic God. Now, I know there's controversy on this. For me personally, I find great delight in understanding this majestic God in this way. If you disagree, that's fine. But for me, this is the majestic God, the powerful God, the one that opens up the text of Genesis 1:1. Bereshith bara Elohim. In beginning, God, the majestic God, creates. He just creates by the voice, by the words of his power. David said, this is the living Elohim. But he does something else. Look at verse 45. There's another name that he uses, which is really embeds itself in the entire theology of Samuel. When David said in verse 45 to the Philistine, he said to the Philistine, you come to me with sword and spear and with javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts. I checked many of your translations that you're using out there. Most of them get it right. One that I read just prior did not get it right. The Lord our hosts, Yahweh Zabaoth. This is an important name in the theology of Samuel. Hold your finger here. Look how Samuel opens up in chapter 1. Just turn back, if you will, to 1 Samuel chapter 1. In 1 Samuel chapter 1, in verse number 3, we have a guy by the name of Elkanah who has two wives. And this man, Elkanah, in verse 3, comes up yearly to worship and to sacrifice to, here's the name. This is how Samuel opens up. Yahweh Zabaoth, to the Lord of hosts. Hannah really encompasses the story of chapter 1, and because of time, we won't go through it. I'm just assuming you know the story of Hannah, who is barren, and she is begging God in Shiloh, oh God, please give me a child, give me a child. I want a son. And look, if you will, at verse number 10 of chapter 1. And she's in bitterness of soul, and she prays to the Lord, and she wept in anguish, and she makes a vow and says, Yahweh Zabaoth. You see, listen very carefully to me, men and women. The theology of Samuel is seen by the usages of the names of God. And the usage of the name of God here is when he speaks of Yahweh Zabaoth, the writer is speaking of unmatched power. The one who controls all things, the spiritual host, the physical host, the visible host, the invisible host. He is in control. So an infertile Hannah, who has no power to create within her body, she appeals to the one who has no boundaries. Yahweh Zabaoth, I come to you. I want a son. And David comes to a foe who is absolutely overpowering, whether it's an infertile Hannah or it's the most unlikely candidate to win a war, an inexperienced 20-year-old coming against a giant. Which is greater, the infertile woman bearing? Which takes more power from God? The birth of a son, conception, birth of a son, or hurling at hurricane power and with precision and preciseness, the stone the size of a tennis ball into the front of this giant, knocking him out. You see, it's Yahweh Zabaoth. Everything about Samuel is lifting up God. It's not about the story. We've lost the message of the story. David and Goliath, go slay your Goliath. That's not the story. The story is about the one who has no boundaries, who can deal in any situation with an infertile woman, chapter 1, or an inexperienced youth in chapter number 17. And this God is so powerful, his methods are going to defy the military appropriateness of the day. And it defies the doctors in chapter 1 of Samuel of the day. God does what he wants to do, and he does it for his glory and for his honor. And why? It says in verse number 47, so that all the assembly will know. I want everyone to know, David says. The battle is the Lord's. The battle will exalt the name of the Lord. That's what the battle is about. The battle is not David's. The battle is not Israel's. The battle is not the Philistines to lose. The battle is not Gath, the giant of Gath. The battle is the Lord's. So many of us today have forgotten that. The battle is the Lord's. But I notice thirdly in verse number 47 that not only is the battle of the Lord's, and not only since the battle is the Lord's, he's going to exalt his name, and how he does that, incredibly so, with these names of God in 1 Samuel 17. But I notice also that since the battle is the Lord's, God uses methods that are just unbelievable. And it says in verse 47 that God does not save with sword and with spear. You see, can I say this to you, men and women? I think most of us want natural explanations for everything. We measure everything up. Okay, how many nuclear warheads do they have? We better have more. Okay, how powerful is their military? We've got to double the size. All right, make sure we diversify with our finances, because if we don't, then a crisis is going to come, and this is what's going to happen. You're going to lose it all. So we spend a lot of time doing it. And I'm not against things, these things. I'm just saying to you, men and women, it really is not about the circumstance. The circumstance to us is living, as the giant is living to the people of Israel. The circumstance is living, and we never see God. We never see God, so we weep our eyes out when our own expectations are not met. This is what I know. I've got to have this. I've got to go there. I've got to be here. I've got to have this position. God, you know this. I mean, you designed me, created me, and you know I should have that. That is not the way God works. I would say this to you, men and women. The one thing I'm learning in these 27 years of ministry experience here at Colonial is this. Before God ever uses a man or woman greatly, he hurts them deeply. I mean, crushed. It is the illustration of Jeremiah chapter 18, where Jeremiah goes down and he sees the potter's vessel and he sees what's taking place and he watches the potter smash the vessel. The beauty of the illustration is the vessel is not discarded, this vessel is remade. And then God says to this Jeremiah, can't I do this with Israel and with Judah? Won't you let me smash you and then remake you? Because there's a lot of self, myself, in my decisions. Every prayer I pray, I am fighting the flesh. Every message I preach, I am fighting the flesh. Every song I sing, I am fighting the flesh. And you think you are capable of making a decision? And you would dare say to God, God, this should be mine. We do see the Israelites doing that to God when they were out in the desert. And as they were out in the desert, they said, we are so tired of angels' food. We want meat. And they all together, we want meat. And the text says, so God gave them their request, but he sent leanness to their soul. What that means is they could not discern. They get their request. I want this or I'm going to cry. I want this or we're going to stone Moses. I want this or we're going to turn our back on you. And God says, okay, you can have it, but you are no longer going to discern. Your spirit will be like a child. What do you want, men and women? I mean, don't we pray and don't we speak to a God that is sovereign, that's in control? Then why do we get up off our knees and we only see that which is around us and we never see that who is over us? Our God is in control. Our God is moving history. As St. Augustine said, history is his story. It is not my story. It is his story. And when I think of a young single, around the 20 years of age, he was head and shoulders. He was tall like Saul, so he probably was just over 6 feet tall. And he was powerful looking. But when you stand next to someone who's almost 10 feet tall and massive, you stand next to somebody who has 126 pounds of armor and a bronze helmet and a spear that's so big it can hold a 15-pound head on it, a shield bearer carrying a full body shield, one who has an arrogant spirit, one who has a foul mouth and says, I defy the God of the armies of Israel. It's interesting in verse number 43, just skip to verse 43 before I give you my last point. When David comes to him, what does the Philistine say in verse 43? The Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? But here it is. So the Philistine cursed David by his gods. You see, this is a war, but it's not a war that you see on the natural plain of Elah. I have been to Elah. I have been into that valley, and you can see the valley, and you can see the hills, and you can, in your mind's eye, see those people lined up, and you just want to shout. But you see, it wasn't about that. It was about the name and the glory of God, and that he is to receive all honor and all glory. And when you see this massive amount of men on either side with spears and with swords and with shields and a massive man in the valley, and down walks a shepherd boy with nothing but a bag, 5 stones, a sling, and a shepherd's staff. God is showing himself mighty. The last point I would give to you is the last phrase of verse 47. Let's look at the verse again. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's. And he will give you, Goliath, into, notice, our hands. Goliath, you had your last meal when you walked into the Valley of Elah. And it's not about me. You walked into Elah like you have done for the last 40 days, morning and evening, and morning and evening. And that's 80 times you have publicly pronounce your distaste for Israel and for their Elohim. Your time is up. He will give you into our hands. You see, if the battle is the Lord's, And God's glory is at stake, and his methods, it's totally up to him, what he, how he uses, what he, how he does it, then that means that if the battle is the Lord's, the outcome is already prescribed. It's already there. And so what does David do? I mean, just look at the significance. Look at verse 49, 50, and 51. Look at these verses. So then David put his hand into his bag and took out a stone, and he slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead, so that the stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face to the earth. And David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. You see, he wasn't killed by the rock embedded into his frontal cranium. But he's killed. He's out. And he takes the sword and he kills him. What are the results? The results are verse 51 to 54. Each verse is significant. Just read it. 51. David ran, stood over the Philistine, took a sword, drew it out, killed him, cut off his head. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. The champion is dead. Verse 52, now the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the entrance of the valley to the gates of Ekron, and the wounded of the Philistines are strewn all across for miles. For miles. The terrified in verse 11 are now the conquerors in verse number 52. What else happened? Verse 53, they come back and they plunder their tents. I mean, they go through the tents and see all of this stuff. And when they would fight, you have to understand, when they would fight, they would take every mechanism they had. They would take their god. They would take their most precious of jewels. They would decorate their god, their stick god, with their most precious of jewels. And it would be in their tent. And each one had their own god and their beautiful jewels. The most expensive thing they owned was not in a bank. It was in their tent, and it was adorning their god. Thousands and thousands of tents full of jewels. So they come back and they plunder the tents. And then verse 54, and David took the head of the Philistine and brought it where? What does your text say? He brought it to Jerusalem? Now wait a second. Jerusalem is still 17 years away. Jerusalem is 2 Samuel chapter 5 and verse number 6, where David is now the king over a united Israel, and his first recorded act as the king over the united nation of Judah and Israel, they're united together, is that he goes and he takes Jerusalem, that is to be the capital. That's 17 years away. And what the text says here is that David took the head of the Philistine and he brings it to Jerusalem. Men and women, this is an unbelievable scripture. Maybe one of the most powerful phrases in all of chapter 17. David lived in a little town called Bethlehem. If you look on a map, Bethlehem is just south of this place called Jerusalem. David lived under the shadow of this impregnable city all of his young life. Stories had been taught about it. When you read 2 Samuel 5, David will say to his men when they take it that they used to laugh and say, who can take Jerusalem? Not even the blind people would be able to defend Jerusalem because it's impregnable. You got to run up the hill and you got a wall up there. All you do is just roll stones down and there's no way. No one could take Jerusalem. But remember back in chapter 16, God had anointed David to be king. And in David's mind, we don't know this because it's not in the text, but I'm just surmising that David's mind is working this way. When I become king, I know exactly where I'm going to put that capital. And what does David do? He walks the 30 miles from the Valley of Elah to Jerusalem. And commentators are divided. In that day, the practice was to take a stick and place the head of the conquered on the stick outside the city to remind the people. Maybe he did that. Maybe he took it and he snuck up there and he put it on the wall. So in the morning they wake up, there's the head of Goliath. I don't know. Maybe he took it and threw it over the wall. Text never says. What the text says is he takes the head to Jerusalem. Now Jerusalem was on call. And for the next 17 years, there was a man out there whose design is to have this city. And God says, this is the city where I will put my name. Jerusalem, Bergen writes, is a trophy of David's obedience to God. David has a city, and the city is not 2 miles south, but it's 2 miles north. And that's where the name of God. God said for the city Jerusalem, I will never take my eyes off this city. This is the city that is to rule the world. I say to us today, brothers and sisters, that the story of David and Goliath is not a battle of a midget with a giant, the inexperienced with the experienced. It's not about those who are greatly developed in military strategy and those who are not. The greatness of chapter 17 coalesces with chapter 16 and chapter 15. That God is not interested in chapter 15 with your sacrifices. He wants your obedience. And that God in chapter 16 does not look at the outward appearance. Man always looks at the outward appearance. What the outward appearance does is move our eyes away from the Lord. And rather than seeing something living in God, we see something living in man. And we see the height of it culminate in chapter 17. Where in chapter 17, David slays a giant so that all the world, all of the assembly, would know that the Lord does not save with sword and with spear, because the battle is the Lord's, and that he'll give you into our hands. You know what the application is for us, don't you? The application for us is powerful. Let me give it to you. Would you turn to 2 Corinthians, and I'll need to be done. We're going to sing in just a moment, Speak, O Lord. Because I want the text to speak to us. But here's another section that's often misunderstood, but a section to me that brings great joy. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul is defending his apostleship. And he beseeches them in verse number 1, he beseeches them by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. And he begs them in verse number 2. And he reminds them that in his writing, he's not somebody that walks according to the flesh. But then verse 3, 4, and 5 just absolutely grip me. Verse 3, for though we, now Paul is speaking of himself, he's speaking of Timothy, he's speaking of Titus. He is speaking of the leaders who are connected with the church of Corinth coming from apostolic direction. Timothy chapter 1, Titus is in chapter 13. We walk in the flesh. Paul is saying, we as those who have led you to Christ and discipled you, we are subject to the frailties of humanity. But what it's really saying, Paul is saying, is I'm just an ordinary guy. I'm just an ordinary man. I got to fight the flesh every day. Verse 3. But our battle strategy is not according to the flesh. Oh, I love this. The weapons of our battle strategy are not made of fleshliness. It might be a better literal translation. They're not carnal. It's not made of fleshly stuff. But they are mighty in God. Our weapons, the way we do battle is we try to carve out from a pagan community, a people of grace in the city of Corinth. What we're doing, we're just ordinary men, but our battle strategy is not according to the flesh. It is prayer. It is the word of God, as my dad spoke just a few moments ago. It is that which is a living God And it's powerful when God takes his word, when God takes prayer. It's so powerful. End of verse number 4. It can pull down any stronghold. The picture of a rope going over and toppling down in wartime, toppling down a wall or a tower in that day. Verse 5, it also not only topples towers, but it also topples arguments. And any high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. And it not only topples arguments, but it topples even the very thought that is contrary to the obedience of Christ. There is nothing greater in our battle strategy. This man, Paul, writes, than that which is placed into the hands of God. And how did we bring a people out of Corinth? How did we do this? And people are looking today to plant churches. How do we do this? Is it through our incredible eloquence? Is it our incredible background and our degrees? And is that what it is? Or is it people who understand we're just ordinary people, and if God would so choose to take prayer and the word and to carve out a people in Virginia Beach that would honor the grace of Christ, then God will get all the glory. But God is so powerful that every argument you give, he'll tear it down. Every thought against the disobedience of Christ, he'll tear it down. That's how powerful our God is. So whether you see it from David's narrative, the narrative of David and Goliath, or whether you see it from a theological section, remember, we are just ordinary people, but our strategy is extraordinary. And it's nothing that you're going to find in a book. It is getting alone with God and crying out and saying, oh God, my teenager is going against truth. Oh God, my boss is so foul. Oh God, my relationship with my wife, my husband, we're struggling. Oh God, there is a need that is in my life right now, and so I cry out to you because I'm just an ordinary guy and I can't do it, but I am saying, Lord, my strategy is to come to you, and if I come to you, you can pull down the towers. You can dissolve the arguments. You can wipe away the thoughts. And I'm begging you, God, to do it. Will you do it, God? And I'm not asking for my sake. And that's key. David never said, I'm going to be the next king. Watch what I do here in the Valley of Elah. Because it isn't about you. But it's about the name and the glory of God, the sweetness of the Spirit, the passion of heaven flowing through my life. And I say, God, please, the battle is yours. Would you stand with me for prayer? Father, we want you to speak to us. We want you to challenge us. We want you to move us from the visible to the human eye, to what is just as real, and that is you, the invisible, but very alive to those that know you. Would you tear down our arguments? Would you tear down thoughts that any person in this building would have contrary to the glory and the majesty of our Elohim? You are Yahweh Zabaoth, the unconquerable one, the unconquerable one who has no boundaries, who can make the infertile fertile and take the inexperienced and use them to display your glory so that all may know that the Lord does not save with sword and with spear. With your heads bowed and eyes closed, and before we sing in just a moment, would you do business with God?
Would you, Christian, this message, I don't know how much more I can open up my heart as I have these last 3 weeks. I am saying to you, brothers and sisters, that what is at stake is not the freedom of the United States of America, as precious as that is. What is at stake is the freedom of your soul. Your souls cannot be shackled by sin and by weights, by expectations and hurts. Your soul must be shackled to God and God alone. The battle is the Lord's. The battle is the Lord's. I'm going to have Meredith play while our heads are bowed and eyes are closed. And would you pray as the words speak to us, take meaning in our hearts? Would you pray?